Just 2 weeks to avoid new lockdown measures. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Independent. Professor Philip Nolan is quoted saying that the rest of the country is 2 weeks behind Dublin and that restrictions imposed in the capital may extend to other counties unless the progress of the spread of COVID-19 is halted. Professor Sam McConkie echoes those sentiments in the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mirror, where he likens the current situation to having a large tiger in your home, which will come back to bite you. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Examiner quotes Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, rejecting a suggestion put forward by a former Swedish advisor to the WHO yesterday that Ireland should allow a controlled spread of the virus among under 60s. Officials dismiss COVID-19 apartheid is the headline there. Today's Irish News leads with a quote from Northern Ireland's Chief Medical Officer Michael McBride, calling on the public there to commit to 6 more months to tackle the virus. The HSE's winter health plan, which is to be published today, generates the lead story in the Irish Times. The paper reports that an additional 1,500 hospital beds are to be provided under the €600 million plan. The government is to haul in the 5 major banks and insist that they help thousands of struggling families whose pandemic mortgage breaks are due to end in 6 days' time. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. The Belfast Telegraph leads with an outbreak of COVID amongst members of Craigavon Ambulance Service who were told tested positive following a golf trip to the Republic. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Irish Daily Star, Irish Sun and Herald all lead with the appearance in Tralee District Court yesterday of 18-year-old Patrick O'Brien, who's charged with harassing the former England and Arsenal footballer Ian Wright. For its lead story, the Irish Farmers Journal reports on remarks made by Northern Ireland's Agriculture Minister Edwin Poots in Stormont this week, who said that while some relatively simple changes on farms could help lower ammonia emissions by around 20%, any further reductions will require government support. The Times gives front page coverage to concerns being expressed by hauliers following the UK government's warning yesterday that following Brexit, there will be possible queues of 7,000 lorries in the port of Dover and 2-day delays to cross into continental Europe. Back on the front of the Independent, there's a report there on the release today of an unidentified 18-year-old woman who suffers from a personality disorder from a secure unit for children after the High Court ruled earlier this week that there was no legal basis to continue her detention. Alongside the caption, "Waiting on justice for the final time," the main picture in the front of today's Times is of staff waiting for Ruth Bader Ginsburg's casket to arrive at the court in Washington, D.C. yesterday. The picture in the front of today's Independent, meanwhile, is of reigning British Open champion Shane Lowry arriving at the Galgorm Golf Resort yesterday with the claret jug tucked under his arm in advance of the Irish Open, which begins today. And finally, the Times provides an update on the Shelburne Hotel statue controversy on its front page this morning. Ronan McGreevy reports that the owners of the hotel are to reinstate the 4 statues which were removed back in July in the mistaken belief that 2 of them were representations of slave women, following several complaints to Dublin City Council that the move was in breach of planning, since the facade of the hotel is a protected structure. We're told that the statues are now being cleaned and are to be restored to their plinths over the coming weeks.
And we'll have more on that later in the programme. Thanks for that, Fiona. It's almost a week since the government confirmed further COVID restrictions for Dublin City and County, restricting people's movements, limiting social gatherings in private homes and closing pubs and restaurants. Last evening, the Department of Health said a further 234 cases of the virus had been confirmed and that 2 people with the infection had died. Speaking at that Department of Health briefing, Acting Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ronan Glynn again appealed to people to cut their social contacts in half.
The power to control this thing is in people's hands out in communities and counties around the country. Ultimately, if we all cut our contacts by half, we will have an enormous impact on the spread of this disease across the country. I've seen discourse that suggests that we need to give the power back to people and let people make choices. That's what we're doing here. That's what we've been doing for weeks. We're telling people that the disease is going in the wrong direction, and they need to listen to that, and they individually need to make choices. Go to your football match, but then don't go to the pub. Or go to the pub, but don't go to the football match. Bring your children to the playground, but don't bring your children to your neighbour's house down the road. These are choices we all have to make. We can't have everything that we had 8 months ago.
Dr. Ronan Glynn. At that same briefing, the chair of NPHET's Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group, Professor Philip Nolan, expressed concerns over the rising rates of COVID-19 in several counties.
The virus is spreading in quite a significant number of counties, particular eye on Donegal, Louth, but not just those counties, Kildare, Offaly, Wicklow, Waterford and Cork. Each have quite different problems, differently and appropriately addressed by the local public health departments. But there's a clear signal here to people right across the country to take careful attention to public health advice, even if they're not subject to particular restrictions.
Professor Philip Nolan speaking last evening. With us here in studio is our correspondent George Lee to talk more about this. First of all, George, the numbers, the reproduction rate, the picture around the country, what's going on in terms of who's getting affected and the speed at which the virus is spreading.
Well, the numbers yesterday were down by 100 on the previous day, which sounds good, but isn't. And the reason why it isn't is that in recent days, over the last 2 weeks or thereabouts, it's an average of 276 cases. What they're saying is for 100,000 people all over the country, that works out at about 74 cases for 100,000 people. Although that was at the height when we were at the worst of this disease, it was 170. It was as low as 3 by the end of June. So it's come back up and it's going up at the moment. One of the issues was how far was that going up and how fast was that going up? And some of the recent averages, like 5 days and 7 days, they didn't go up as much as they would have thought. So it is conceivable that maybe there was some sense to which it may be slowing down, but far too soon to know. When you look at the number of people in hospital now, it's 95, with 16 in intensive care. And so when you look like that, the reproduction rate, as they say, how often this virus is going, it's still pretty much in around the same range it was last week, 1.5 to 1.7. So again, it hasn't taken off over the past week. And they're saying that at that rate, it would double the number of cases in every 12 to 14 days. But that would still leave us with about 100,000 cases or thereabouts by late October if we didn't carry on. So the numbers all over the place. The metrics, as it was described, of this disease continue to go up, all of the metrics.
But by NPHET's own account, on the basis of what they were saying earlier this week and at the end of last week, it's still a bit too early to say whether or not the Dublin city and county restrictions have had an effect, have begun to come through.
Far too soon, because mostly if somebody is infected with the disease, it takes a couple of days before you'll end up with symptoms and so on. So the die is cast, is how they put it last week. So the numbers that we see this week and certainly up until maybe early next week would have been the effect of infections, which would have happened just before this, the new changes and restrictions would have happened. But they say that it does take some time. But having said that, you look at, say, the likes of Dublin, where the incidence was very high. And yesterday, for the first time, I noticed that there was some kind of easing in terms of the rate of increase. Even in Dublin North, where the rate had been really high, over 205, 206 per 100,000, it came down yesterday to about 196, 197. So, you know, some areas it's beginning to slow down. But there are areas, and they did focus on, and did use examples of counties who are getting it right and counties who really have to get it.
Well, they identified a number of counties in relation to which they have specific concerns. In fact, parts of counties, which was interesting in itself.
It was interesting about that. They mentioned parts of North Wicklow and East Kildare, but those really are very close to Dublin, and part of North Wicklow to me sounds like Bray, which is very, very close to Shankill in Dublin and South Dublin. And you know, you're looking at Leixlip when you're thinking about East Kildare and so on. So they're the Dublin area, but they weren't focusing and saying, and when asked, they weren't saying we're definitely going to be extending the Dublin criteria to them, more so just noting it as well. The counties where they're most concerned and significantly concerned still remain Donegal, where one third of the cases in recent weeks have been in between the ages of 15 and 24, and the reproduction rate is over 100, and we had about 30 cases in Donegal yesterday. County Louth, where again there's a lot of household transmission of the disease and household clusters, and again up around 100. And remember, 100 of an incidence of a disease is four times over what would qualify you for the green travel list, which means that you wouldn't have to isolate. So it's very high. And then also Waterford. And in Waterford, one of the issues they did point out was that there had been an outbreak in a meat factory down there. It accounted for about a third of the cases. It's conceivable if they get that under control, it might be a different picture compared to the other two, but different issues in each county. They said the thing is that what people should look at in counties and communities everywhere, look at the example of Leitrim, look at the example of Limerick, look at the example of Tipperary. In all those three cases, the incidence was very high in recent weeks, and in each case, it's down much, much lower now. And they said that's a case where, combined with maybe in Leitrim, I think there may have been an outbreak which they got under control, but it is that communities are doing it for themselves. And again, this was really, really strong in the message that came across from every commentator at that briefing yesterday. There were four, and it was about people taking action themselves and making sure that they driving home about the social distance, driving home about how important it is for people not to spread this disease, that it is the way of reducing it, and if we can reduce and ration those social contexts.
Right, what they're saying is if people do that, then we don't need to move to the next level of restrictions in some of the counties that are operating at level two now. But where are we in relation to that? NPHET meets again today. Will it be considering whether there should be some extension of restrictions to elsewhere in the country?
They meet today. This is the acting chief medical officer, wouldn't be drawn on what they would or wouldn't recommend. He said there will be recommendations after it because they always have recommendations. One of the things they're going to look at, obviously, is all of these numbers and what they mean. And they are concerned about certain counties. They have to figure out whether or not they're going to do something now or something or wait another week or so. But they wouldn't wait forever because these things are very dangerous. And this disease does. They're talking about exponential growth. We are looking at the conditions for exponential growth, which means could really take off in so many of these places. So they will look at what the figures are saying, they look at the counties, and they'd look at what recommendations wouldn't be drawn on.
And just a final question, George, about the age profile of those who are being infected. I mean, we've seen in recent times 60-70% of those who are contracting the virus or are confirmed as having the virus has been under the age of 45. Is that a pattern that's continuing?
It is. There still is much more prevalence in terms of the incidence among younger people, but it is very clear, and it was highlighted, that there's a growing incidence now among older people. It's very difficult to contain it to one age group because we're all so connected. But certainly in that age group, I think it is up to the mid-30s, up to 34 from the late teens. That's one area where, again, and you can see it's flashing red in terms of the incidence in recent weeks, and certainly in the past week. It's again the social interaction, and it's why it was so big on their agenda to drive home that we have to do more in terms of reducing those social contacts.
Very good, George Lee. Thank you for that. 22 minutes past seven.
Four statues of African women bearing torches removed from the Shelburne Hotel in Dublin in July in the mistaken belief that two of them were statues of slave women are to be reinstalled. The hotel on Stevens Green in the city centre, owned by US property company Kennedy Wilson and operated by the Marriott Group, has told the City Council they will return the statues to their plinths outside the hotel where they had stood since 1867. For more, let's talk to art historian Kyle Layden, and first to Ronan McGreevy, who has the story on the front page of the Irish Times this morning. Ronan, good morning. Remind us why the statues were removed.
They were removed in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement and its emphasis on the legacy of slavery. It was around the time that the Colston statue in Bristol was thrown into the river. So there had been a complaint from somebody in America, and on foot of that, they decided to remove the statues.
Kyle, good morning and thanks for taking our call today. You discovered the original catalogue from where the statues were ordered and found that they weren't slaves. Tell us more about what else you found.
Yes, that's right. The idea of these statues being slaves never sat terribly easily with me. So when I'd heard the statues were removed, I decided to try and do some research to see where the idea had come from. And certainly I could find no older source than Elizabeth Bowen's 1951 novel-esque evocation of the Shelburne and its people, which stated that the statues were in fact slaves. A simple online search of the foundry which made the statues brought me to its 1867 trade catalogue from which the statues would originally have been ordered. This reveals that they were originally designed by the French sculptor Moreau and were mass-produced both as lamp standards and fountains. Examples exist all over the world, from India to Paraguay. In no other example of the pair are any of them referred to as slaves. In the trade catalogue, they were simply given titles which referred to the ethnicity of the two women represented. One was Egyptian, the other sub-Saharan African. I then searched the archives of the Irish Builder, a contemporary magazine which detailed building schemes across the country. So on the 1st of March 1867, a correspondent provided a comprehensive technical description of the new Shelburne Hotel building, which stated that the statues were of Egyptian maids, so just Egyptian women, which were purchased not by the architect or indeed the owner of the Shelburne, but rather directly by the builder of the building from the foundry in France. Nowhere in any of this was there any evidence that they were to be seen as slaves. And as I said, the only source which I could find which named them, any of them, as being slaves, and it was only two of them, was Elizabeth Bowen's 1951 book. And I think as a result of that, there was a certain degree of circular reinforcement of the idea that at least two of the statues were slave girls. Elizabeth Bowen describes two as Elizabeth as Egyptian princesses as a result of their headdresses, and the other two she describes as slaves. But nothing older than that could be found.
Why do you think these statues were chosen by the owners in 1867?
Well, they were part of a mania for all things Egyptian, which really followed from Napoleon's campaign in Egypt from 1798 to 1801. Napoleon wished to vest that campaign with Enlightenment legitimacy. And so he sent a huge band of artists and scientists to Egypt in the wake of his troops to study Egyptian culture, which for the first time in history became widely known in Europe. As a result, all things Egyptian suddenly became extremely fashionable in Europe during a movement called Egyptomania. The main attractions of Egypt to these people were really references to luxury and wealth. And obviously, those were extremely useful when you're building a new hotel to refer to the luxury and wealth of the patrons and what you might expect when you actually visit the hotel. And that certainly would refer them more to being representations of aristocratic Egyptian and sub-Saharan African women rather than slaves.
Ronan, why are the statues going to be reinstalled and why now?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, Gavin. One is that, you know, the hotel itself, and there's been an enforcement notice served on the hotel at the end of July, stating that they were that there was a possible breach of planning permission. These are part of the facade of the Shelburne, which is done up in 2016, and the facade is a protected structure. So there was an enforcement notice sent from Dublin City Council, and they had to respond to that, and they asked for an extension of 4 weeks to respond to it. So now this is their response, that they had commissioned a report by Professor Paula Murphy, who confirmed really what Kyle has just told you there, that they are not depictions of slave women, and therefore they will be restored to their plinths.
Kyle, as you had explained previously, that the golden bands on the feet of the women are seen to be jewellery rather than shackles. But given the context of the conversation which led to their original removal, could the statue still be felt to be offensive to those sensitive to how our culture is represented and how women or black people are depicted?
Well, absolutely. And I've always substantially agreed that there are definite issues with the statues. And the one positive thing perhaps to come out of this is that I'm very glad that that conversation has taken place. I've made a career of trying to make people think about the meanings of the built environment. And this conversation has certainly done that. There remain three, I suppose, main problematic issues with the statues. Firstly, there can be no doubt that they form part of a common 19th century artistic fetishization of the culture of the East as licentious and sexualized. The post-colonial academic Edward Said, of course, famously cast such representations as the creation of a cultural hierarchy where the Occident was centered and the Orient was othered. There's no doubt that the statues form part of that Orientalist discourse. Secondly, regardless of how true the slave identification actually was, the fact that there's clearly a very widely held misconception that they might have been slaves might in itself be enough to justify a call for the removal. And finally, it's not really my place as a white man to comment on the impact these statues might have on a woman or a person of colour who views them today. But such impact, of course, may itself again be a reason for their removal. The one difficulty, obviously, I have with the planning issue in relation to this particular matter was that it seemed to be being put forward that this idea that the conversation which had started as a result of what seems to be an illegal removal was in itself a reason to justify that removal. And I think that would be a very dangerous planning law issue in itself. Furthermore, I do think that the removal of the statues would be somewhat disproportionate. They are, of course, part of one of the most important 19th century architectural ensembles in Ireland, really the only surviving 19th century hotel on this scale anywhere in Ireland. They weren't intended to have any political meaning, and certainly, in my opinion, whilst accepting their problematic nature, I still think the removal would have been disproportionate. Any issue with their supposed meaning could have been dealt with by the hotel by affixing a plaque to one of them or printing a leaflet. Senator Batchuk, of course, my old law professor, from whom I hold the highest esteem and respect, said that one woman's anklet is another's manacle. But by the same token, it's just as true that one person's problematic representation of African women can, when properly contextualised with a leaflet or with a label on one of the statues, be a potent reminder that two of the world's most ancient civilizations, which far outstripped anything formed in Europe in antiquity, longevity, and cultural output, were found in Africa, and their glories and the glories of Africa were still being celebrated in 1867.
Kyle Layden, art historian Kyle Layden, and Rona McGreevy from the Irish Times, thank you both very much for speaking to us this morning.
The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar is today launching the third round of funding under the Disruptive Technology Innovation Fund. The government-backed fund is open to those developing cutting-edge technology. 140 million out of the 500 million euro available has so far been allocated following the first two rounds. Businesses expect turnover to be 30% less than this time last year. That's according to the latest survey carried out by Chambers Ireland. The data shows that while larger firms are suffering relative to a normal year, SMEs have been hit hardest. Outstanding invoices are becoming an increasing problem, with 47% of firms that issue invoices struggling to get paid. Critical Healthcare has invested over €500,000 in a new facility in Tullamore, County Offaly. The provider of medical and healthcare products said the new facility will allow them to meet increased demand due to COVID-19. The team has also increased its workforce to over 30 employees. Taking a look at the currencies, €1 buys 91.7 pence sterling and $1 16.6 cents.
After a grim night, it's finally stopped raining in Dublin. Wonder is it much brighter in Cullybacky? Porrick Lodge has the sports news.
Good morning, Gavin. Yes, the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open will get underway in the next short while at Galgorm Castle in County Antrim. There will be a very different feel to the tournament this year as it's being played behind closed doors. Greg Allen is up early and is already in place at the course. Good morning, Greg.
Morning, Porrick. Yeah, no rain here at all. A calm, cool first morning of an Irish Open, and it's an Irish Open like no other. It may have its smallest prize fund in over 20 years. There are no spectators, but this is one of Europe's most traditional titles in golf, running for almost a century and on an unbroken run since 1975. And it's still on the calendar, which is saying something in these times. And we've the reigning Open champion Shane Lowry competing on a golf course that he saw last evening for the first time, having flown back to Ireland on Monday, isolating at home under HSE advice, and driving up yesterday and wandering casually in for his press conference with the claret jug dangling from one hand. It was just that kind of sprinkling of stardust moment that really switched on the green light for what has understandably been a very low-key week so far. And after finishing 18 holes of practice, he said he liked what he saw around this tree-lined parkland course, making reference afterwards to the lush, damp rough here being a very serious factor. And that's saying something, considering he played all four rounds of the US Open last weekend, where the rough was a particular talking point. Lowry tees off at 25 past nine, less than an hour from now, in the company of the informed South African George Coetzee, who won the Portugal Masters a fortnight ago. He also won on the African Sunshine Tour a few weeks before that. He's the world number 81, and he's right in form, so Coetzee is a serious contender this week. Among the other Irish players here, by the way, apart from Lowry, 2007 champion and twice Open champion Paddy Carrington tees off at 1 o'clock, playing in what is his first tournament in almost 7 months. Cormac Sharvin from County Down, he knows the course very well. He was the leading Irish player in last year's Irish Open. He tees off at 20-1 in company with Paul Dunn, and we're underway with the first three-ball match teeing off in just a few minutes at 20-8.
Okay, Greg, we'll check back in with Greg for a further update in an hour's time. Chelsea's new signing Kai Havertz, who recently joined from Bayer Leverkusen, scored a hat-trick in a 6-0 hammering of Barnsley in the third round of the League Cup in England. Two goals from Joe Linton helped Newcastle to a 7-0 demolition of Morecambe. Everton's impressive start of the season continued with a 5-2 win at Fleetwood, and Arsenal beat Leicester 2-0 at the King Power Stadium to set up a fourth round game against the winners of tonight's match between Lincoln and Liverpool. Dundalk's European campaign continues tonight. They play away to Sheriff of Moldova in a one-off game in the third qualifying round of the Europa League. Kick-off is at 7 o'clock. Also tonight in the UEFA Super Cup, it's Bayern Munich versus Sevilla in Budapest. Atletico Madrid have signed Luis Suarez from Barcelona, with the Uruguayan striker penning a 2-year deal, bringing to an end his 6-year stint at the Nou Camp. Kildare's Peter Kelly has announced his retirement from inter-county football. In his debut season for the Lilywhites in 2010, Kelly won an All-Star as the side, then managed by Kieran McGeaney, reached an All-Ireland semi-final. In 2014, he was part of the Two Mile House team that won the All-Ireland Junior Club Championship. The Munster Council has published its fixture list for the upcoming championship. The Hurling Championship will begin on Sunday the 25th of October with a clash of Clare and Limerick at Semple Stadium. The Munster Hurling Final will take place at 4 o'clock on Sunday the 15th of November, while the Football Final will have a 1:30 throw-in on Sunday the 22nd of November. All matches will be decided on the day, so there's provision if needed for extra time and penalties. Defending champions Newcastle West have been knocked out of this year's Limerick Senior Football Championship. They lost last night's quarter-final to Adair by 5 points. So the lineup for the semi-finals next Sunday is Adair against Galbally and Ballysteen versus Ballylanders. Wales' rescheduled Six Nations game against Scotland at the end of the month will be played in Llanelli, the first time the town has hosted an international game for 22 years. It'll also be the venue for the Autumn Nations Cup game against Georgia in November. Both matches are expected to be played without spectators. Wales are unable to play at their usual venue, the Principality Stadium in Cardiff, as several parts of the stadium have been converted into a temporary hospital to deal with the ongoing pandemic. And finally, in racing, Willie Mullins and Paul Townend teamed up to win the €150,000 Guinness Kerry National at Listowel. Cabaret Queen at odds of 6-1 finished a nose in front of Moyhenna in a photo finish. Action is due to continue in Listowel today with a flat card, but the meeting is subject to a track inspection shortly.
Irish hauliers and exporters say that an alternative route to Europe must be found to avoid potentially massive queues at British ports from the beginning of January when the UK leaves the European Union. A leaked British government letter suggests British exporters to the EU face possible truck queues of up to 7,000 vehicles at ports in the UK if the industry doesn't prepare. The concern here, of course, is Irish trucks getting caught up in the congestion. Addressing the Minister for Transport directly in the Dáil yesterday, Independent TD Verona Murphy, who's a former president of the Irish Road Haulage Association, called for Ireland to reduce its dependence on the UK land bridge to access continental Europe.
Why are you not moving heaven and earth to reduce the Irish economy's reliance on the UK market and the UK land bridge? The UK government, its current actions are clearly designed to threaten both the Irish economy and the Good Friday Agreement. It's time to be proactive. The time has come to put the vital daily ferries to mainland Europe in service. Doing so now will dramatically reduce the risk to Ireland's trade with the EU.
Independent TD Verona Murphy. We can talk now to John Martin, who's Northern Ireland Policy Manager with the British Road Haulage Association, and to Eugene Drennan, President of the Irish Road Haulage Association. Thank you both for talking to us on the programme this morning. Eugene Drennan, can I come first to you? What at this stage do you assess could be the impact, particularly of a no-deal Brexit, but even if there is a deal, the impact of all of this on trade across the land bridge between Ireland and continental Europe?
It will be huge, Brian. We've been warning of this for nearly 2 years now, that trade will be upset, and now it looks like being severely upset. Both here internally, the national haulier who needs to pick up goods from the seaports will be blocked up because of mayhem. And then the feed of goods and services in from the UK will be severely hampered by paperwork and customs and the general goes slow. And the land bridge, which is obvious to people now over the last few days, with any little bit of a hiccup at all, it leads to thousands of trucks being they call it stacking on the M20 motorway before you go to Dover or Folkestone for the ferries or the train. And anything like that the flow is so big, the numbers are so big now, it creates havoc.
There are, of course, direct routes between Ireland and continental Europe, but most of our imports and exports still go across the land bridge, do they, through the UK?
Yes, they do, because of the timeline. But of course, that is going to change now if there's havoc in the UK. That's why we are calling for a daily, fast, efficient service into Northern French port. And I've also added to what Miss Murphy said in the Dáil, that we need it as a PSO service at the start, so that the operators can have surety of revenue and we can have surety of service, and to give the service a time to bed in.
Perhaps I can turn to John Martin. Michael Gove, who's the UK minister responsible for no deal planning, John Martin, has said that between 30 and 50% of trucks crossing the English Channel won't be ready. And he's warning that UK imports and exports could be adversely affected for up to 3 months. You say he's involved in a blame game.
Yes, as far as we're concerned, the Road Haulage Association in the UK have been lobbying government from day one. And our original ask has been to ensure there was clarity provided in a timely manner to ensure that everybody had time to implement their systems and procedures. There's three key columns to the delivery of the end of the transition period. The first one was the UK government is to recruit 50,000 customs agents. Mr. Gove has been asked recently on three occasions how many have been recruited. He refuses to answer. And even if these people were recruited, they have to be trained. There's a GBMS service for the delivery. It's an IT system. It hasn't been introduced. They're working on it, but it hasn't been introduced even in testing format. And then there's the FRT, Smart Freight System, which is another IT system to enable operators to check to see if all their paperwork's ready before they enter into the Kent area. This, again, is not developed or in operation. So the government has failed to deliver, despite all the pressure that the sector has put on it, to ensure this is a smooth ending of the transition period.
Can I focus on one of those, the last? This, and it's described, I think, as the Kent Access Permit. Yes. Trucks, whether they're Irish or UK or continental trucks, using Dover pass through Kent. Are we now talking about border controls at Kent before trucks would be allowed to enter and make that final approach to Dover?
Well, in a sense, yes. If you haven't got approval to enter, obviously the authorities will have access to the database, if it's developed, to check to see if a specific vehicle registration number is on the system. And if it's not, in a sense, yes, it is. It's an entry permit into the Kent area. If you haven't got your paperwork right, you shouldn't be in Kent, because, as you've already alluded to, they're estimating, worst-case scenario, there's going to be 7,000 trucks. It takes a big car park to park 7,000 trucks.
Eugene Drennan, another layer of regulation and bureaucracy.
Yes, indeed, Brian. And to add to that, our own customs here are not really up fully and running with our systems, and there's no connectivity then to very similar to what John has said, and there's no, as of yet, because, as he's just explained, connectivity from our systems to their systems. And the amount of freight just Ireland-UK, which will be part of the logjam, is approximately between 800,000 and 1 million units a year, travelling each way. So the volumes, as I said, are very big. And here we have a system, we're going to have a system, if we have food product on board, where we have to give a 24-hour notice to revenue. We have to apply for a pre-boarding number to get on the ferry at all. And if there's any customs or revenue detail with that, we have to go on to another system. So we have to go through three systems that aren't fully linked up as of yet. Mm-hmm. And likewise, as John has said, we should be trying our systems here on our Irish port side now in October, ready for January, and that's not happening.
Well, we're only 3 months away, or not much more than 3 months away at this stage. But Eugene, what might be the impact of all this in terms of how people here would experience these delays? You know, when they go into the shops, what kind of products might not be on the shelves? What might it add to the price they have to pay to your costs, and ultimately the costs to the end consumer?
Well, simple stuff such as bread, flour, and the ingredients for bread are all imported here now. So that's the simplest model, and you could expect it to perhaps double in price, and a delay, which is sometimes scarcity, if this gets really tugged up, then to the medical and to pharma, it's just not acceptable, the time delay that may happen, and the surety within the service, and then to the international trade here and to Ireland Incorporated, when you wouldn't have surety of service, surety of timeline of delivery, and to agricultural product, if you're not in the markets on the time of day you're supposed to be there, you've lost your position, you've lost your the market. So it's
perishable yeah. goods particularly.
Perishable or maybe ambient, that may be just a chill, whichever yeah. they are.
John, I mean, Northern Ireland hauliers, talk about them for a moment. They also will transit in some cases through Dublin to Holyhead. Is that going to present them with difficulties if they're leaving the UK, entering the EU and trying to do business with customers in Britain?
There has been a bit of clarity provided in relation to the UK or the GB borders. Because Northern Ireland is sort of going to be governed by the NI protocol, nobody knows the detail of the protocol. And say this is coming to the end of September, and we still haven't any clarity in relation to the protocol. So if a Northern Irish truck is going to mainland Europe, it will be going through the Dublin port, so it will be subject to customs checks and all the paperwork in Dublin port, transiting through GB, and it'll be subject to more checks in the south of England. So they'll be doubly checked. People have now realised, because of COVID-19, that logistics is a very finely balanced industry. Everything is just in time delivery. And particularly fresh product coming from Europe in relation to your vegetables and those type of things, we need access, and it needs to be streamlined. We can't afford, the sector can't afford, nor can business afford 2 days sitting in a car park in Kent, because the product will be off, and the just-in-time delivery for products will be totally up the left. So there'll be a huge impact on the public at large and on industry.
All right, no doubt this is something we will return to in the weeks ahead, but for the moment we leave it there. Thanks to John Martin from the British Road Haulage Association in Northern Ireland, and to Eugene Drennan from the Irish Road Haulage Association.
Right across Europe, hopes of a quick rebound in economic activity are starting to fade. As COVID-19 cases begin to rise once again, a so-called second wave will no doubt put further pressure on the world economy. At this time of uncertainty, how are the banks coping with the COVID shock, and are they prepared for Brexit? We can speak now to the man responsible for leading the supervision of banks across Europe. Andrea Enria is chair of the Supervisory Board of the European Central Bank. You're very welcome.
Hello, good morning. Good morning.
You've had meetings with senior people in the Irish banking system over the last few days. How satisfied are you that the European banking system in general and in Ireland will be able to withstand the impact of the COVID pandemic?
Well, the European banks have entered this crisis with a much stronger capital and liquidity position, and a much improved asset quality. So this has enabled them to continue lending to households and corporates, small businesses, and without materially tightening the credit standards in the first phase of the crisis. And that's also thanks to the policy measures which have been taken by the ECB and national government. So far, let's say, the ability of the banking sector to react has been fairly good. But of course, this is one of the harshest recessions on record, and it will have an impact on banks' balance sheets. We ran what we call the vulnerability analysis in July, and we try to estimate how the balance sheets of banks would develop in different scenarios. And in the scenarios that still now our economists define as the most likely, let's say banks would be able to, to manage a sort of short-lived and deep recession like the one we are experiencing. But of course, if the recovery is weaker than expected and more delayed than expected, then of course the impact on the bank's balance sheets will be harsher, and it could lead to significant deterioration of asset quality. In the severe scenario that we consider, for instance, that would be up to 1.4 trillion non-performing loans potentially generated in this situation, which is higher even than what we experienced in the last crisis. So we need to prepare, and that's what we are urging the banks to do.
The bank's main priority over the past few months have been tackling the consequences of the pandemic, but they also need to be preparing for Brexit. Are the banks on track to finish their preparations by the end of the year, given that many will be operating in a more fragile environment?
Well, we think that we have done all the possible efforts in preparation to Brexit as supervisors, and we asked the banks to do all the preparations, and we think that they have moved significantly in the right direction, and they are now ready to take the hit to some extent. Licenses are in place, or temporary recognition of licenses are in place to continue serving the customers on both sides of the channel. We have target operating models which have been defined for banks which have relocated business, and banks are on good track to achieve the target operating model on time. And there has been recently a decision of the Commission to grant temporary equivalence to UK's central counterparties, which was essential also to avoid, let's say, financial stability concerns, especially in the clearing of derivatives, I would say. So all in all, the preparation has been done, I was meeting with my team, and we cannot think of anything else that we could do or we could ask the banks to do. But still, Brexit, of course, will have macroeconomic effects on top of the COVID-19 impact. And financial markets have not yet have been priced in entirely the possibility of an exit of the UK from the Union without a trade deal. So we still need to be, you know, the fact that we are prepared to a shock doesn't mean that the negative effects will not be there, of course.
As payment breaks come to an end and the banks come under pressure to keep non-performing loans down, are you satisfied that consumers will be adequately protected? And what message did you convey to the banks in this regard?
Well, payment breaks have been an essential element in the response to this atypical crisis originating from the pandemic. So they have been fundamental to avoid that the necessary containment measures which have been taken to deal with the pandemic caused an unnecessary destruction of productive capacity and especially harm also to households' finances. So it was a very important element in the policy response to create breathing space in the period of the lockdowns and the bridging to the recovery. Now, as the situation evolves, it's clear that banks may well have to consider to extend payment breaks to their customers. Still, what we think as supervisors is that it is also important that they take into the consideration the impact that this has on their asset quality, so avoiding the build-up of unrecognized non-performing loans and eventually, avoiding distinguishing good customers from bad customers that are unlikely to pay. So these, it is now time, we think, for banks to start becoming more active in recognizing, let's say, their asset quality issues, also to avoid a huge, cliff edge effect at the end of the payment break. So banks need to become more active in this respect, and that's a point that we flagged to their attention with a letter in July.
Okay, Andrea Enria, Chair of the Supervisory Board of the ECB, thanks for joining us. That's the business news for the moment. Back to you, Gavin.
The September summer is definitely over. Let's see what the weather has in store for the rest of today. Matthew Martin is at Met Aaron.
Thanks, Gavin, and a very good morning here from Met Aaron. Well, we are now definitely in a more autumnal phase of weather, and a deep low pressure system is going to track in across the south of the country this morning. This will bring some very strong winds to the far southwest of the country, with a yellow wind warning in operation for southwest Munster this morning. There is also some heavy showery rain wrapped around this low pressure, and there is a yellow rainfall warning in operation for parts of central and northern Leinster for some heavy downpours. So a very windy start this morning in the southwest of Munster, with some very strong gusts possible at the coast there. It will be a cool and blustery day nationwide, with showers and longer spells of rain spreading across the country. There will be heavy and possibly thundery bursts in places, and some localised flooding is possible. However, there will be dry and sunny intervals too, and the best of these are expected across parts of North Ulster. Highest temperatures for today of 11 to 14 degrees in fresh to strong gusty northerly winds. Staying breezy tonight with clear spells and some showers, and fairly cold with lows of 4 to 8 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, then it looks set to be a bright, fresh day with sunny spells and just scattered showers. However, towards evening, the thickening cloud will bring some rain to parts of the southwest. Highest temperatures for tomorrow of 11 to 14 degrees. And then looking ahead to the weekend, we can expect a good deal of dry weather overall. Rain will clear from the southwest early on Saturday to leave much of the country dry with sunny spells, with temperatures of 12 to 15 degrees. And plenty of dry weather across the country on Sunday also, with sunny spells for many, but turning cloudier at times in the west with the odd burst of rain possible. It will become a little milder by Sunday with highs of 13 to 17 degrees. So then to recap for today, very windy to start in the southwest of Munster, with a yellow wind warning in place for here. It'll be a cool and blustery day nationwide, with showery rain spreading across the country, giving some heavy bursts, but there will be some sunny spells as well. That's your forecast. Thanks for listening and have a good morning.
Public health experts are widely referenced across a number of today's front pages. Professor Philip Nolan is quoted in the lead story in the Irish Independent saying that the rest of the country is 2 weeks behind Dublin and that restrictions imposed on the capital may be extended to other counties unless the progress of the spread of COVID-19 is halted. Professor Sam McConkie echoes those sentiments in the lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror, where he likens the current situation to having a large tiger in your home which will come back to bite you. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Examiner quotes Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, strongly rejecting a suggestion put forward by a former advisor to the WHO yesterday that Ireland should allow a controlled spread of the virus among under-60s. Today's Irish News, meanwhile, leads with a quote from Northern Ireland's Chief Medical Officer Michael McBride, calling on the public there to commit to 6 more months to tackle the virus. The HSE's winter health plan, which is to be published today, generates the lead story in today's Irish Times. The government is to haul in the 5 major banks and insist that they help thousands of struggling families whose mortgage breaks are due to end in 6 days' time. That's according to the lead story in the Irish Daily Mail. The Belfast Telegraph leads today with an outbreak of COVID amongst members of Craigavon Ambulance Service following a golf trip to the Republic. And the Irish Daily Star, Irish Sun and Herald all lead today with the appearance in Tralee District Court yesterday of 18-year-old Patrick O'Brien, who's charged with harassing the former England and Arsenal footballer Ian Wright. For its lead story, the Irish Farmers Journal reports on Northern Ireland Agriculture Minister Edwin Poot's assertion that government support is needed to dramatically reduce farm emissions. Back in the front of the Independent, there's a report there on the release today of an unidentified 18-year-old woman who suffers from a personality disorder from a secure unit for children after the High Court ruled earlier this week that there was no legal basis to continue her detention. The picture in the front of today's Independent, meanwhile, is of reigning British Open champion Shane Lowry arriving at the Galgorm Golf Resort yesterday with a claret jug tucked under his arm in advance of today's Irish Open. The Shelburne Hotel statues are to be restored to their plinths over the coming weeks. You can find out more about that story on the front of today's Times. And there's a good story, or there's a good picture on the front of today's Examiner of images from an exhibition on Nanonagle Place in Cork on life in the city in the 1920s, including during the influenza pandemic. A teenage girl is pictured wearing a face mask, looking at an image of another Cork woman also wearing a face mask 100 years ago. Elsewhere this morning, the Times gives coverage today to a Workplace Relations Commission ruling that a nursing home should pay €150,000 to 3 staff members who were sexually harassed by a 93-year-old resident with dementia. Another WRC ruling, which also receives coverage in today's papers, is that a clamping company was not unfair in dismissing a staff worker who worked in tandem with four of his colleagues to boost their bonuses by clamping as many cars as possible. The Happy Clampers is the headline over that story in The Star. Yesterday's letter to the Irish Times from a woman in Tipperary who was convinced that she saw a UFO in the skies last Friday prompts letters from two other people, one in Raheny in Dublin and one in Derry, who also saw the same bright lights. And finally, remember Patrick and Oliver Morgan, the two fishermen who saved the lives of two cousins off the coast of Galway during the summer? Well, the father and son team are back in today's papers after they rescued a man from the River Corrib yesterday morning. The two fishermen were heading out to sea when the emergency call came through, and after pulling the man out of the water, they then transferred him to the care of Galway City Fire Brigade. Following the rescue, the duo received widespread praise on social media, including one comment which described them as part-time fishermen, full-time superheroes.
It's Thursday, the 24th of September. This is Morning Ireland. The 8 o'clock news is read now by Brian Jennings.
The HSE winter plan to be published today promises around 900 more acute beds, including over 50 critical care beds. Under the plan, most of the extra €600 million in funding is to be provided next year. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
This winter plan for the health service covers the period from now up to next April. Of the extra €600 million being provided, €200 million will be spent this year and €400 million next year. Around 900 extra acute hospital beds are promised, including over 50 critical care beds. It also commits to hundreds of extra lower level subacute and community beds to relieve pressure on acute hospitals. It's unclear how many extra medical, nursing and other health staff will be recruited to service these extra beds. Just under 5 million extra home support hours are to be provided. GPs will also have access to more diagnostics in public and private hospitals, with around 80,000 of these sessions provided for. The 30-page plan, approved by the Department of Health, will be published today by the HSE.
The National Public Health Emergency Team is meeting today to discuss the course of COVID-19 and decide what, if any, recommendations need to be made in respect of several counties where the level of the virus is increasing. It comes as officials warn that efforts over the next 10 days will be critical in suppressing the virus. Laura Hogan reports.
A key figure on the National Public Health Emergency Team warned that all the metrics used to measure the growth of COVID-19 here are increasing. Professor Philip Nolan said the reproductive rate of the virus is now far too high, somewhere between 1.5 and 1.7, and that the goal is to get this back down below 1. There is a grave concern about the increase in cases among people aged over 65, which are now four times higher than they were 5 weeks ago. Officials said this is now a nationwide problem and that Donegal, Louth, Waterford, Kildare, Offaly, Wicklow and Cork are also showing a high incidence of the virus. The Acting Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, said it's vital that people in every county now reduce their contacts in the days and weeks ahead.
The Mental Health Commission has expressed concern about current testing of staff for COVID-19 across mental health services. A paper published by the independent statutory body says the national testing system was inconsistent and untimely between March and July this year. It has called for the system of testing to be strengthened to protect service users ahead of a possible second wave. Our social affairs and religious correspondent, Alva Keneally.
The Mental Health Commission supported 181 services in managing and mitigating COVID-19 between March and July this year. It continues to do that work, but it's using the learnings from that period to ensure any weaknesses can be combated in the coming weeks. The Commission's study notes that the national testing system was inconsistent and untimely, and that there was confusion among some services as to which health guidance they should be following. It says there were significant inconsistencies around staff testing in mental health services, and it says the use of dormitory-style accommodation was a factor in disease progression in services worst affected by the virus. The Commission has called for a more robust regulatory framework that will help protect service users and staff against winter flu and any COVID-19 surges. To do that, it says, the rollout of a transparent, time-bound and rapid testing process for staff and residents is key.
US President Donald Trump has refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power should he lose the upcoming election in November to Democratic challenger Joe Biden. Mr. Trump also said he believed the election result could end up in the US Supreme Court, as he again cast doubt on postal voting.
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
People are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else.
Two police officers have been shot and injured in the U.S. city of Louisville during protests that followed the decision not to prosecute two of three officers involved in the fatal shooting of a young African-American woman, Breonna Taylor. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets overnight calling for justice. Now the time is coming up to 7 minutes past eight.
RT Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. Thinking of switching your mortgage? The Ulster Bank mortgage team are available to talk. Hail, rain or shine.
It will be a cool and blustery day with showers and longer spells of rain spreading across the country. There will be heavy and thundery bursts in places and some localised flooding is possible. Dry intervals too, the best of these are expected in North Ulster. Highest temperatures 11 to 14 degrees. And there's a warning that west winds veering north to northwest will reach gale force 8 or strong gale force 9 today on Irish coastal waters from Carnsore Point to Mizenhead to Loophead, occasionally reaching storm force 10 this morning between Mizenhead and Loophead.
A winter plan for a winter like no other, as public health doctors express grave concerns for the spread of coronavirus and an increasing demand for hospital care, including intensive care, the HSE will today set out how to get the health service through the next 6 months, promising around 900 more acute beds, including over 50 critical care beds. Here's the HSE's Chief Executive Paul Reid speaking on Virgin Media's Ireland AM in the past hour.
We are heading into a winter season. We want to keep all of our hospital services up and running. A lockdown has proven bad for the health service, not just for society, not just for the economy, but for the health service. So, you know, the call to the public to do the right thing right now protects the health services for the winter.
That's Paul Reid. Let's speak to our health correspondent now, Fergal Bowers. Good morning, Fergal. What are the main elements of the plan in terms of extra beds and staff?
Well, we get a winter plan from the HSE every year, and this year obviously has the added backdrop of COVID-19. But in any event, the plan has to deal with the wide range of winter pressures that we always see from autumn until next spring, with flu, respiratory problems accompanying the cold weather. So an extra €600 million is promised, €200 million this year and €400 million next year. This plan runs up to next April, so it's not all happening, you know, now. It will take 7 months to complete. I do understand, I think the HSE believed a longer a phased run-in up to June might have been more advisable, but it is up to next April. A big area promised are the extra hospital beds. So around 900 more acute hospital beds, and that includes over 500 intensive care unit or critical care beds. And that's important because today, if you look at the HSE, there's 282 adult critical care beds staffed and open at this point in time.
Sorry, did I get that number wrong, Fergal? You're saying over 500 critical care beds?
No, 50 extra intensive care unit or critical care beds. But today there are 282 adult critical care beds staffed and open at this point.
Where are they going to get these extra critical care beds?
It's unclear. It's not clear how many extra medical, nursing or other staff will be recruited to service these beds, or where they will come from, or how many hospital consultants will be appointed. I mean, the rough estimate of opening one new critical intensive care bed, it's about €1 million. So if you open 900, that will cost you roughly €900 million. It's much more than the amount being allocated. So there are questions here. And also, where are the physical facilities in place to open all of these new beds? Because, you know, opening new beds is important, obviously, but a week ago we could see from the figures that 243 beds were closed in hospitals for a mix of reasons, but including staff shortages. So I suppose realism in opening that scale of beds is important. Also, extra hospital beds and staff were promised in any event in the programme for government, so some would see some of these elements as a repetition of what has been promised already. There's also to be hundreds of extra subacute and community beds. There are lower level beds in the community to relieve pressure on acute hospitals.
Tell us about the use of private hospitals for diagnostics for GPs.
Yes, we're promised a greater access for GPs to diagnose patients. So that would speed up the diagnosis for a variety of patients. GPs are being promised 80,000 diagnostic sessions. So these would be this would be patients going for scans and tests, and these would be secured in both public and private hospitals. There's also a promise for 5 million, just under 5 million extra home support hours to be provided, likewise to help keep older people out of hospital. Now, this 30-page plan has been approved by the Department of Health, and it will be published today, this morning, by the Health Service Executive.
Staying with private hospitals, Fergal, is there any plan to use them in the same way they were used earlier on during the year to create extra bed capacity, particularly for ICU?
Yes, we already know there has been a fund, a multi-million euro fund put in place to use private hospitals, and also a tender system has been put in place so that hospitals would provide tender to provide a variety of services that may be needed over the coming period. So yes, private hospitals will be used, not quite in the same way as earlier during the COVID-19 pandemic, where they were effectively taken over in block and made into public facilities. That system won't be used.
As you said, Fergal, a winter plan is always announced around this time of the year because winter is a particularly challenging time for the health service and they tend to need more money to cope with it. But this winter is very different.
It is. COVID-19 and winter are, a very difficult mix, and we haven't seen it before. So it is going to be a winter like no other. The capacity to deliver services slowed and were paused during COVID-19. And because of precautions needed to keep patients and staff safe, things are moving slower. There's a couple of big areas. Any significant emergency department overcrowding will be a nightmare and indeed dangerous for patients and staff. And we've seen on one single day this month already, according to the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, 277 patients in terms of overcrowding nationally, and we're not really into the winter yet. And at one hospital, University Hospital Limerick, planned procedures were cancelled for 3 days because of overcrowding. Waiting lists are also lengthy, at record levels indeed. 827,000 people waiting for some type of care at a hospital at the end of last month. So these are difficult backdrops to the overall winter plan. Only time's going to tell if these commitments are delivered on time. Like winter, health plans come and go, and I suppose history tells people to be cautious about plans and commitments in health plans. We'll have to wait and see whether that quite large scale of beds can be delivered with all of the staffing and equipment and facilities that are needed to service such beds.
Fergal, thank you. That's our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
A former British ambassador to the United States who resigned after the leak of confidential correspondence describing the Trump administration as inept and dysfunctional has strongly criticised the UK government for its plan to break international law in relation to keeping an open border on the island of Ireland. Ambassador Sir Kim Durock resigned last July after President Trump, in response to the leak, tweeted that he was stupid and pompous. Sir Kim, who has published an account of his time in Washington called Collateral Damage, warns that by walking away from commitments on the border with its contentious internal market bill, Britain is now endangering the prospect of a post-Brexit trade deal with the United States. He's been telling me why.
I think that if Joe Biden wins the election on 4th November, then I think his priorities in trade will be more around an EU-US free trade deal, which would be much, much bigger than a free trade deal with the UK. And I think some of his team have already said that publicly, or they will be around the US joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that that big Pacific trade package. So I think for them it wouldn't be an obviously strong economic priority compared to EU or Pacific deals to do a deal with the UK. If it's Donald Trump, as it could well be still, then I think he would prioritise a UK-US free trade deal. But the Democrats have the power, if they hold the House of Representatives, to block that. And feelings are running, I judge, quite strongly in the Democrat Party on this issue. So I think that that in this case, their concerns about the Good Friday Agreement would override the economic arguments here.
I mean, it's a concern that's been there almost from the outset, the Good Friday Agreement, the what happens in relation to the border on this island. And you write in the memoir, and I quote, "I reckoned the Irish embassy in DC were stirring things up. And the words I came to dread most were, hey, can you explain this Irish backstop to us?" How were the Irish embassy stirring things up? What were you seeing that led you to come to that conclusion?
You are, and you have. I mean, this was intended as a compliment to your team in Washington. Extremely effective. And there are a number of senators and congressmen of an Irish background who follow events in Ireland extremely closely and followed the Brexit negotiations very closely, who were part of the support for the Good Friday Agreement. And they take these issues very seriously. And their links with your team in Washington are very strong. And you know, you have the St. Patrick's Day annual event, which every other embassy, I would say, in Washington envied, when your Prime Minister Taoiseach would come across and get an annual meeting with the President, and lots of celebrations of the Ireland-US relationship, which in its way is very special too. So you have a powerful voice in Washington.
So they were doing an effective job on behalf of all of us at that time, I suppose, was your conclusion. Just in relation to another aspect of all of this, the risk that the UK could, in the way it's behaving, torpedo a trade deal with the European Union. Now, that obviously would be very serious for this country, given the importance of trade between Ireland and Britain. What do you see are the signs there?
I think that the European Union have so far played this particular dispute, this argument about the internal market bill, very calmly. I think it is sensible of them not to have walked away from the negotiations, to continue with the negotiations, which are, there's another round imminently. But I do think that if the bill goes through with the provisions that the government have put in about potentially breaching international law, I can't see, even if the Commission was to endorse it, which I think is doubtful, I can't see it getting through the European Parliament. So I think it's, as I say, sensible of the Commission to play it calmly and to continue with the negotiating process for the time being. But I do think it could be a huge obstacle if things stay as they are.
If I could turn to your resignation last year, people perhaps may remember some of the controversy around it. And one aspect was that Boris Johnson, now British Prime Minister, was running for the Conservative Party leadership at the time. He was on the hustings, as it were, and he was asked on television, would he back you when you've been attacked by Donald Trump? And he kicked to touch, I think is a fair way to describe his response. Now, you spoke to Boris Johnson subsequently. I think he phoned you, is that right? And you had a conversation with him, and he asked you, was his behaviour on that occasion a factor in your decision? What did you say to him?
I said it was a factor, but I told him, and I said many times subsequently, there were a number of factors. The fact that the president had tweeted that they would no longer deal with me was obviously a big factor. But it was a judgment that reflected an overriding view that I could no longer do the job effectively and deliver for London, for my government, what they would expect from a British ambassador in Washington, an ambassador anywhere, in the wake of the leaks. The leaks had made me think that it would be impossible to get the same confidences and the same insights from people inside the administration that I believed I was able to get hitherto. So what the then candidate, now Prime Minister, said, as I said, was a factor, but I wouldn't say it was the main factor.
You anticipated, perhaps even predicted, the Trump victory back in 2016. I think you said that it was the likeliest outcome that he would get the Republican Party nomination at that stage. This was in the early part of the year. And that he would beat Hillary Clinton, you thought, because, and again I quote you, she was damaged goods with serious likability and trust issues. What are your thoughts about 2016? You've already told us that you think there is a prospect that there could be a Trump re-election.
Yeah, look, I think it is. I'm only seeing the polls and reading the reports like everyone else. I suspect it is closer than it looks. Biden looks to be comfortably ahead in the national polls and ahead, though, by a smaller margin in all the battleground states. But the polling wasn't very accurate in 2016, and I just question whether their models are better this time. That's factor one. Factor two, we still have the debates to come. And some 85 million Americans watch the debates, and they can play a critical role in people's decision on how they will vote. So they come, I think the first one is next week, and those potentially can be a turning point as well. Also, you have to question whether random events or I mean, for example, if there is a sudden breakthrough on a coronavirus vaccine, that can affect how people vote, because the polls also suggest that people still have more confidence in terms of economic policy in the present administration and in the Republicans than in the Democrats. So I think there's still a lot to play for.
The former British ambassador to Washington, Sir Kim Darroch, speaking to me a little earlier.
Companies are still reporting a 32% decline in turnover, despite the reopening of most of the economy after the COVID-19 restrictions. That's according to the latest report by Chambers Ireland. The data shows that while larger firms are suffering relative to a normal year, SMEs have been hit hardest. A telecommunications company involved in the implementation of the National Broadband Plan is to create 50 jobs in this country over the coming year, and a further 20 new positions in Poland. Kilkenny-based Entegro have announced plans to set up a design support centre in Poland. The total of 70 new staff will bring new hires to over 100 within 12 months. The Family Business Network has called for a reduction in capital gains tax from 33% to 20%. It said this would spur investment in family firms, which contribute 80% of Ireland's economic value. Taking a look at the currencies, €1 buys 91.7 pence sterling and $1 16.6 cents.
And it's good morning once again to Pádraig Lodge. Pádraig.
Brian, thanks very much. Good morning again. Well, play is underway on the first day of the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open at Galgorm Castle in County Antrim. Plenty of Irish involvement, but no spectators present this year. We can go live to the course now and join Greg Allen.
Thanks, Pádraig. Play underway just around almost an hour. It could not be calmer out there, but with an overnight grass frost turning to water, the already heavy rough is saturated, and that could be quite a factor for the morning starters, one of whom is Shane Larty, who tees off at 25 past nine within the hour. He got his first view of the course yesterday evening, but he won't want for local knowledge because his caddy, Brian Beaumartin from Ardglass in County Down, knows this course very, very well. For Larty, he said yesterday there was never a moment when he thought he would not return for the Irish Open. That's after 7 months living in the United States, and driving up yesterday brought back memories of his famous Open Championship victory 14 months ago.
You know, it's my first time back up north since I was talking to my uncle as I drove into Belfast on the way up, and I said, geez, the last time I was here I was going home with the Claret Jug. So obviously it's a little bit different this week. I've probably not got the feel we would like here, but you know, there's a few Irish lads here and we'll do our best to kind of put on a good show for everyone, and you know, hopefully one of us can maybe pick up a home win this week. It'd be nice. A couple of amateurs in the field, so you never know. But yeah, it's, look, I've never been shy to say that, you know, the Irish Open has been a huge part of my life and a huge part of my career. So hence the reason I'm here.
And Larry is the home favourite and the tournament favourite. And of course, there's another Open champion playing this week. But Pádraig Harrington has played no tournament golf for 7 months. He has an injured knee as well from running on a treadmill, trying to get tournament ready, so to speak. And understandably, he has very low expectations.
I can't I can't have expectations. That's just it. Look, I'd love to play well. I spent 6 months working on my technique, which is, people wouldn't understand that. It's kind of the opposite of working on your game. Tried in the last week to play a few rounds of golf. I've played a Wednesday Invitational four ball. I've played a Champagne Scramble. Anything to get myself playing one shot, try and be competitive. You still can't. You can never replicate actual tournament play. So you'd normally want a couple of events. I would want a couple of events in any way to get competitive. I don't have that luxury, but I'm going to take what I get this week.
And Harrington is on the course at 1 o'clock. And so far, with around 20 players on the course, one player is off to an extremely hot start. Dean Burmester, the very long-hitting South African, 3 under par after four holes. And he leads by 2 strokes from Ewan Ferguson, Nicholas Lemke and David Law.
Very good, Greg. And further reports from Greg on the News at 1 and Drive Time. Live television coverage begins at 1 o'clock on RTE2 and you can get score updates whenever you want them on rte.ie. In last night's soccer action, Chelsea's new signing Kai Havertz scored a hat-trick in a 6-0 hammering of Barnsley in the third round of the League Cup. 2 goals from Joe Linton helped Newcastle to a 7-0 victory over Morecambe, while Arsenal beat Leicester 2-0 at the King Power Stadium to set up a fourth round game against the winners of tonight's match between Lincoln and Liverpool. The League of Ireland champions Dundalk continue their European campaign tonight. They play away to Sheriff of Moldova in a one-off game in the third qualifying round of the Europa League. The winners secure €300,000 in prize money and a home tie in the final playoff round. Kickoff is at 7 o'clock, while in the UEFA Super Cup it's Bayern Munich versus Sevilla in Budapest. Hollywood stars Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney are planning a takeover of Welsh club Wrexham. Members of the Wrexham Supporters Trust board voted overwhelmingly in favour of the takeover, with the pair promising to realise what they describe as the fantastic potential of the oldest professional club in Wales. Frank de Boer has been named as the new head coach of the Dutch national team. The 50-year-old has been appointed on a 2-year contract up to and including the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Katie Taylor's next fight will be in November. It's been confirmed that she'll take on the unbeaten Spaniard Miriam Gutierrez. Racecourses across Britain have outlined the financial consequences of no crowds returning to venues for at least 6 months. The Jockey Club said its previous estimate of a £75 million shortfall in revenue will now be substantially higher, as courses will also be losing out on hosting Christmas parties, conferences and exhibitions. Today's meeting at Listowel will go ahead after a track inspection this morning. The ground remains heavy following a further 10 millimetres of rain overnight. Fresh ground will be used today. Yesterday, Willie Mullins attended just his second meeting since March, and he made the trip to the Kingdom worthwhile as 6-1 shot Cabaret Queen won the €150,000 Guinness Kerry National under Paul Townend. Kildare defender Peter Kelly has announced his retirement from inter-county football. Kelly won an All-Star Award in 2010 as the Lily Whites reached an All-Ireland semi-final. In a statement last night, Kelly said it had been an honour and a privilege to fulfil a childhood dream in wearing the white jersey for over a decade, saying he had soldiered with some of the best people he'd ever met and made lifelong friends. Former Derry minor captain Conor Glass will return to Ireland after a spell playing Aussie rules. Glass's contract with the Hawthorne Hawks expired after the club's final game of the season last Sunday. He's expected to continue his studies at UUJ and may rejoin the Derry panel. New Zealand Rugby has broken ranks with its Southern Hemisphere partners and demanded a change to the Rugby Championship schedule, complaining that the All Blacks will be forced to spend Christmas in quarantine upon arriving home from their final match against Australia in Sydney on the 12th of December. And finally, organisers of the Pro 14 have announced plans to stage Monday night games for the first time this season. The first Monday fixture will be Munster against Cardiff Blues at Thomond Park on the October bank holiday.
Ireland's economy shrank by 6.1% between April and June. Earlier this month, the Taoiseach warned that Ireland was headed for a budget deficit ranging from 25 to 30 billion euro by the end of the year. And we've already heard predictions from the IMF that the world is facing its deepest recession since the 1930s. We've been assured that unlike the credit crisis 12 years ago, Ireland's economy is now fundamentally sound. With access to cheap borrowing, Ireland can carry the burden. But many are already hurting during this COVID recession. How bad will it get? And how should Ireland weather the storm? Tommy Mescal reports.
You can't ignore gravity for very long. We've been able to suspend the laws of, if you like, economic gravity for some time because it's been a disaster. But the disaster, the emergency phase of this crisis is over.
I'm the former owner of the now closed Good Hair Company on Main Street, Ebbyfield, County Limerick.
Financial crisis, the ash cloud, foot and mouth disease, 9/11 in the States. I would take two of them together rather than have to deal with this. It has been just extraordinary.
An economy in hibernation, on life support, or placed into deep freeze. The descriptions have varied over the past 6 months, but like the virus that has caused this recession, its full effect is hard to ascertain. Some businesses will survive COVID, others will be left reeling for some time to come. And for those most unfortunate, COVID-19 will close their business for good.
There's a vast amount of uncertainty about what the future shape of the economy will be, what people's economic prospects are going to look like, and where people will work in 2021.
Stephen Kinsella is Professor of Economics at the University of Limerick.
If you're on a higher incomes with a secure job, things are far better for you than somebody on a low income with a less secure job. The second part is a huge amount of the employment in our economy, you know, 68% or so, is in SMEs, most of whom are very small. SMEs need continuous funding. They need to trade every day. The disruption has created a massive funding gap. The SRI has estimated that the funding gap will be something between 9 and 15 billion euros. For the next few months. The state can and should help balance and meet that gap. That doesn't mean that all SMEs will survive. It will create a massive retraining problem for Ireland because lots of firms, I don't think, will survive.
During the height of the pandemic in Ireland, the documentary Abbey Feelgood aired on RTE. It told the heartwarming story of the 16 successful barbers and hair salons in Abbeyfeel, County Limerick, the town with the most hairdressers per head of population. One of those featured was Billy Mann of the Good Hair Company.
Salon was always about good hair and good company. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to call the salon the Good Hair Company.
As he sat down to watch the documentary on April 20th, he knew all was not well.
It was a quite a poignant moment, actually, to be honest, sitting on the couch watching it that night, because at that stage, I had a feeling that things were, the tide was turning and going back out, and I didn't think I would be on it this time. I had a rental property, I had all of those extra bills that I would have to pay, etc. And I knew the longer that this was going on, I knew more of my resources would be depleted.
Around what time would you have decided these doors aren't going to open again?
Unfortunately, the week of my birthday. I was 52 on the 27th of June, and it was that week. Those of us that work in hair salons in the towns and the small towns of Ireland, we're all local, and in like the likes of Ebbyfeel, quite a substantial employer within the town. And if the likes of me and other salons start to go, suddenly you no longer have staff earning money. So the knock-on effect is there.
It's Fader Lane. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
We would have done the Obama and the Queen Elizabeth visit for both the Gardaí and for the state and the OPW. And on the back of that, we handled entirely the 1916 commemoration events in Dublin City Centre.
David Mongey is owner of Mongey Communications in Kildare, which provides sound and vision for some of the country's biggest events. For David, payment breaks on expensive equipment are drawing to a close. His valued staff are seeing reductions in their COVID support payments. He fears the reality for businesses like his is starting to bite.
We've been very lucky in terms of the COVID scheme, the payment schemes, but they have been significantly reduced, and some of my team here have taken a bit of a hit in that regard. The banks gave us 6 months, and the finance houses. In the event side of our business, we've people here for here almost 20 years. And, you know, it's not something you learn in college working in this industry. It's experience. And the big fear is that we're going to lose that talent.
Paul Gallagher, General Manager, Buswell's Hotel. The hotel is synonymous, I suppose, with the activities across the road in Dáil Éireann being so close. Years ago, the bar was here. It was never across the road, so the bell to vote would ring here once upon a time. That doesn't happen anymore.
You had a difficult morning of it today. Can you just explain to me what happened this morning and the phone calls you had to make?
This morning, out of the 26 staff we had working in the hotel, 21 of those was spoken to this morning and were laid off. So it leaves the hotel from what was 60 people in the hotel prior to COVID to only 6 staff now. So total collapse in our business altogether. Our turnover's collapsed by over 90%. Our occupancy has declined from 90% to 12%. No recovery since we've opened on the 29th of June. It has been a complete struggle up to now, and it's just getting worse, quite honestly.
How much longer can a hotel like this survive?
We hope that we will reach a point where recovery comes and our business can start to build again. Clearly, if that doesn't happen, there is a very limited road beyond March of next year, quite honestly. And that's a huge concern for all of us here. But I don't want to worry my staff any more than they are currently today. But clearly, this is a business that's in some serious trouble.
Paul Gallagher, General Manager of Buswell's Hotel in Dublin City Centre, ending that report from Tommy Meskell.
German health officials have declared Dublin a COVID-19 risk area, requiring anyone in the arriving in the country from the Irish capital to take a free COVID test. If they're negative, they can continue on their way. If positive, they're required to quarantine for 10 days. The Irish Times Berlin correspondent Derek Scally has a story. Good morning, Derek. Thanks for talking to us.
Good morning, Brian.
So why has Dublin found itself on this COVID-19 risk area list?
Well, Germany, since the start of the COVID crisis, it said it considers a risk area anywhere where there have been more than 50 new cases per 100,000 population over a 7-day period. And by the Irish officials' own data, Ireland has cracked. It's almost up at 72, so well over 50. And they've been monitoring Ireland like all of the world in the last weeks. And they said it had cracked it last week, but they said they just allowed to see it. Was it a blip? Is there a pattern? And they said, yeah, the numbers were just going in one direction, so they announced it. So at this stage, basically half of the EU, either in full or in part, are classified as risk areas by Germany. Yesterday, joining the list alongside Dublin were Lisbon, Copenhagen, and border areas of Austria and the Czech Republic. So we're by no means alone.
So it's travellers then from Dublin, but I'm not sure at the moment whether there are any flights into Germany from other airports. But in effect, it applies to the whole country.
Indeed, it's coming in, but it's also going out. So anyone arriving in, as you said in your introduction, they either can produce a COVID test from Ireland no older than 48 hours, and that liberates them from any need to test in Germany. If you haven't got that test, you either get tested immediately on arrival or within a 48-hour window. Within that 48 hours, until the test result, hopefully negative, is there, you are asked to restrict your movements. If it comes back positive, you are to self-isolate for 10 days. But from a German perspective, it's not a travel ban. They are still allowed to come to Dublin. Mm-hmm. But if they have, let's say, a package holiday, they can cancel without any cost to them.
So entering Germany, at the very least, you're self-isolating, quarantine for 48 hours until one would hope a negative test came back.
Exactly. Or you get a test here before you go. Leo Varadkar was in Ireland, in Berlin, from Saturday to Monday, and he had a test before he left. So if he was travelling now and he had a negative test, he wouldn't have to isolate and he could go about his business.
Right. Is this list reviewed, Derek? Is it something they return to every number of weeks? Do countries come on?
Yeah, it's on a weekly basis. It's put together by the health authorities, but also the foreign ministry and the interior ministry, and they take in other accounts and other things into account, how good is the testing regime and so on. It should be pointed out, by the way, Munich in Germany is now also a risk area, so people from Munich are not really welcome elsewhere in the country, and they've also imposed masks in public areas there. So the situation in Germany is by far not as rosy as people might think. It's getting more serious there as well, but definitely Ireland is in good company now. Lisbon, Copenhagen, France, lots of areas.
Yeah, we know that in the EU, Germany is a large and important country. Do other EU member states take their cue from Germany in these sort of matters?
Yes, we've seen other countries. For instance, last week, Germany declared Vienna a risk area. Belgium was quite quick to do the same. And lots of areas, countries bordering on Germany, are watching this very closely. For instance, the Czech Republic, the border areas of the Czech Republic are now a risk area. But there are 30,000 commuters from the Czech Republic who travel into Bavaria every day. So they're working very closely with the German authorities because for them, the economic knock-on is immediate.
All right. Derek Scally in Berlin, thank you very much indeed for that. The time, 6 minutes to nine.
More people have been cycling over the past 6 months, and local authorities around the country have provided temporary infrastructure to allow for that. A coastal mobility route installed by Dunleary Rathdown Council from Blackrock to Sandy Cove has attracted much attention, and as part of our National Bike Week coverage, our reporter Coleman O'Sullivan has been getting reaction to the new route.
We put it in as a temporary measure in response to COVID-19. What we were seeing in May was there was a huge increase in cyclists, about 100% compared with last year. And we felt it was necessary from a safety point of view to put this in place because we were concerned about conflicts between vehicles and cyclists, but also pedestrians, because we're dealing with COVID-19. There's a need for extra space for pedestrians on footpaths and also for cyclists.
Robert Burns is Dunleary Rathdown's Director for Infrastructure and Climate Action, and the driving force behind the segregated two-way cycle route that now runs for almost 4 kilometres between Blackrock and Sandy Cove. Along the route, it's not hard to find people who think it's a great idea. Jamie Short cycles out about once a week just to use it.
I do love it. Like, it's a great route, especially coming down along this stretch with the coast. It's a gorgeous view, great sea air in it and all.
But Robert Burns is keen to say the route is not primarily for recreation. It is a transport corridor rather than a greenway, and on a weekday you can see commuters going to work and family groups to school. Sisters Coco and Cora O'Rahilly use it with their mum for their school run.
I think it's very good because
we can see the sea all the time.
Yeah, and I think it's very good for cars as well, so they can see where they're, like, the cyclists are going, and the cyclists find it very, I think the cyclists will find it very good too, because it goes both ways, so nobody needs to squeeze in or anything.
But not everyone is happy. Some residents say it makes traffic and parking more difficult on nearby routes as drivers are pushed off the coastal road. In Monkstown Village, we met Mark and then Christy.
I think it's very good for the economy, where you're blocking people and getting up and down to do business. I think you should be more like you have down in Sandy out there. They want to do the same thing down on the coast there. It's not good for people who want to conduct business, like car parking. You have to pay a meter, a whole lot and stuff like that. You know, it has to be a happy balance, you know. I don't think there's really a need for it.
It's a joke, because tonight we're getting round and I seen an ambulance stop there the other day. And it was, I take somebody out of the I don't know, I have a house. There's about 30 cars backed up. Nobody could cross over because of the curb for the cyclists. And then I think there could be a cyclist in danger because the kids are all over the place and the speed of cyclists coming down. Very, very dangerous.
However, another Monkstown resident, Gwen McNulty, gave this response.
Well, I'm very positive and very pro it because I think we all need to be on our bicycles. And I think if I look at from a planner's point of view, and my children and their children's children, I want my kids to be able to get out of bed, put their feet on the ground, and to exist in a world that's healthy and that is, you know, pollution free. I mean, it is a nuisance for everybody who lives in Monkstown, the extra traffic and parking and all of that, but I think that's something that we have to adjust to.
For the moment, the coastal mobility route is a temporary measure, but without a definite end date. Robert Burns says the council have commissioned an independent evaluation of the route to inform any decisions about keeping, changing or dropping it. But he says its future will really depend on the popular response.
I guess that will be down to the people. It'll be down to the people who live in this area. It'll be down to the elected members. It'll be down to the council. So if it's embraced by the people, more than likely it'll be kept. If there are issues with it, then there may be a different decision. But it could be maybe something in between where it's kept with certain changes.
And that report from Coleman O'Sullivan. 2 minutes to nine.